Let's jump back into our story today in 1 Kings chapter number 13, where we are looking at how the kingdom of Solomon fell apart. He died, I believe, right around the spring or summer of 941 BC. He had been on the throne for 40 years, and then he fell away from God at the last couple of years, and he ended up with opponents rising up against him. And one of those very significant opponents was his forced labor boss for the northern tribes, a guy by the name of Jeroboam. And Jeroboam ends up becoming the king of the northern kingdom of Israel once Solomon dies and his son Rehoboam basically tells the northern tribes, "Nah, you thought my dad was bad. I'm going to be worse with y'all. I'm going to be even more strong, forcing you guys to do work and labor and taxing you." So that's how the kingdom fell apart. And the next thing we know is that Jeroboam realizes if he does not come up with a plan to keep the northern Israelis from going back down to Jerusalem on a regular basis for the temple, for worship there, he's not going to be king of the northern tribes for very long. So he comes up with a brand new religion. Well, it's actually just a twisted form of the worship of the God of Israel. He has two golden calves, representing, no doubt, the creator god of the Egyptians. He'd just been in Egypt, remember. And he has one of them placed up in the north at Dan. The other one he puts just a few miles north of the border that has just been established between his country and southern Judah. He puts it at Bethel, a place that is very significant in Israeli history. And then he decides that there needs to be another fall festival to draw the attention of the northern Israelis away from the Feast of Tabernacles. Because remember, we've got three mandatory festivals: spring Passover, late spring Pentecost, and then late summer, beginning of fall, Feast of Tabernacles. So he established a new fall festival in the eighth month. And I think this is all happening really rapidly, because as I told you, I believe the coronation and the fallout and the split and all of that happened in the seventh month of the Jewish year of 941 BC. So now we're ready for the dedication of this new altar at Bethel, this new worship service at Bethel, this new fall festival at Bethel. And we've also got the king, Jeroboam, deciding that he should be kind of the high priest of this new faith, of this new religious aspect of his kingdom. And it gets disrupted by God's prophet. So let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 13 and read from verse 1. "Behold, a man of God," just another term for a prophet, "came out of Judah by the word of he who is to Bethel. Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make offerings." So he is going to be acting as the high priest at the dedication of this altar. "And the man cried against the altar by the word of he who is, and said, 'O altar, altar, thus says he who is, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you, and human bones shall be burned on you.'" And that is a prophecy that comes completely to pass later in our story. Then, verse 3, this unnamed prophet gave a sign that same day. This is the sign that he who is has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be torn down. That is, it's going to break up right here on the inauguration day. And the ashes that are on it shall be poured out. So it's going to be a big failure for the inauguration of this system of worship. Now, when the king, meaning Jeroboam, heard the saying of the man of God, which he had cried against the altar at Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, "Seize him!" And you can picture it in your mind, can't you? He's like shocked that this guy is interrupting the dedication service, and he just points right at him and orders people to grab that guy. And then we're told this. His hand, which he'd stretch out against him, meaning pointing at this unnamed prophet, dried up so that he could not draw it back to himself. Now, some people imagine this, that his hand suddenly drops to his side and it all shrivels up and becomes completely like a skeleton with skin on it. I don't think that's actually what happened here. I actually believe that it was frozen in that pointing situation, that it probably did lose all of its muscle tone. I think the joints, though, the elbow and the shoulder joints seized up, and he could not pull it back. And the altar also was torn down, meaning the stones, at least on one side, maybe all sides, suddenly just fell. Maybe there was like a little mini earthquake, a little very localized earthquake underneath this altar. Because the moment that those blocks fell out, ashes poured out from the altar according to the sign that the man of God had given by the word of he who is. So this has all the markings of God disapproving supernaturally of this ceremony. And keep in mind, we're only a few months after the death of King Solomon, and during the time that Solomon was on the throne, that's when the temple was built. That was when everybody was all excited about the services that went on at Jerusalem. And so all of the people in attendance at this illicit dedication ceremony had been to Jerusalem multiple times to see an official worship service. Many of them may have been there the day that the temple built by Solomon was inaugurated by the supernatural signs of God. You know, the glory cloud filling the temple building and the fire falling from God upon that first inaugural altar dedication. And so now they're seeing a negative form of that. And so then the king, again, Jeroboam, said to the man of God, "Entreat now the favor of he who is your God," which that phrase always grabs me when I see it. I know in some instances it does not seem to indicate that the person is denouncing their own faith in he who is. But sometimes it kind of feels like that, which this is one of those times that Jeroboam is saying, "Would you please talk to your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored to me?" So Jeroboam in his confession here may be acknowledging that he's not on speaking terms with the true and living God, even though he seems to be indicating that all the Israelis should be trying to worship that God through these golden calves in this ceremony. So he basically wants his arm back. And so the man of God entreated he who is, and the king's hand was restored to him and became as it was before. So the joints loosen up. If it had shriveled up as I expect it had, then the muscle tone comes back and he's able to have it as normal. Now, what was the purpose of all this? Well, it kept the guy from getting arrested, didn't it? It made it very clear that any type of attempt to take action against this prophet for just passing on the word of God would not be tolerated. The king's attitude has changed, though. He figures he ought to try to develop a relationship with this very powerful prophet. So the king said to the man of God, "Come home with me, refresh yourself, I'll give you a reward." So you healed my arm, you're very tied in with God, come to my house, I'll feed you, take care of you, I will provide you some beneficial thing for helping me get my arm back. But the man of God said to the king, "Even if you gave me half your house, I will not go in with you. I will not eat bread or drink water in this place, for so it was commanded me by the word of he who is saying, 'You shall neither eat bread nor drink water nor return by the way that you came.'" So he had been given very specific instructions. He was to be on an absolute fast for his trip. Now, he doesn't have an awful long ways to go. From Jerusalem up to Bethel area, probably right around 10 miles. So call it a 20-mile round trip. That's less than a day's walk by the standards of old. So he was not supposed to eat or drink anything. He was not supposed to be staying overnight with anybody. So he makes it very plain, "I can't stick around. I got to go. I can't even go back by the same route that I came," according to the instruction of the Lord. So he understood his mission parameters very well. Verse 10, "So he went another way and did not return by the way that he came to Bethel." Now, an old prophet lived in Bethel. Now, what do they mean by old? Well, more than likely 60 or older. And he is, that would indicate then that he has been around for the entirety of Solomon's reign. So he is probably quite well acquainted with all the worship of the true and living God at Jerusalem, and he has been serving as one of God's prophets, one of God's supernatural spokespersons. But now, in this first year, first few months of this illicit religion in the kingdom of northern Israel, he seems to have been going along with that. So his sons came and told him all that the man of God had done that day in Bethel. So he wasn't at the ceremony. Maybe that was some consideration against what was going on. But the sons, who are probably all full grown and have their own sons pretty old, they told him the whole story. You know, the whole prophet's message, the freezing of the king's arm, the splitting of the altar, the fixing of the king's arm, all of that. So they also told to their father the words that he had spoken to the king. Their father said to them, "Well, which way did he go?" And his son showed him the way that the man of God who had come from Judah had gone. So they knew which direction he was heading just a few minutes ago. And so he said to his son, "Saddle the donkey for me." So they saddled the donkey for him, and he mounted it. And he went after the man of God. So he's trying to chase this guy down. Why? The text really doesn't tell us. It may simply be that this guy indicated such a power, such a connection to God, that this old prophet wanted to make contact with him. Maybe wanted to piggyback a little bit on that. We have to speculate a little bit. So he found him sitting under an oak, which I tell you every time we come to this, probably not an oak tree like we think of an oak tree, but rather just a big tree, maybe a terebinth. And then he said to him, Are you the man of God who came from Judah? So there's a guy just sitting there, taking a little siesta, a little rest, and the old prophet goes, hey, are you the guy that was just at Bethel? And he says, I am. And he said, come home with me and eat some bread. And he said, I may not return with you or go in with you, neither will I eat bread or drink water with you in this place. For it was said to me, by the word of he who is, you shall neither eat bread nor drink water there, nor return by the way that you came. So he repeats again his mission parameters, so he understands them quite clearly. But then the old guy does this. He said to him, well, I also am a prophet, as you are, and an angel spoke to me by the word of he who is. Now, that's a lie. We know it's a lie. And he said to me, bring him back with you into your house that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. Again, why did he do this? Because he wants this guy to come to his house for whatever reason. Like I said, maybe to piggyback on his power, his connection to God. So, we have the big problem now. Verse 19. This unnamed prophet went back with him, ate bread in his house, and drank water. He broke his mission parameters because somebody told him, hey, an angel told me to tell you, it's okay. You can come with me. You can drink water. You can eat some bread. It's fine. God has given you different orders. And here's the deal. This younger prophet, this unnamed prophet, should never have accepted that as authentic information without checking in with God himself to see if God would verify a change directly to him. Whatever way God gave him the message, that would be the way God would change the message, not by some angel to this prophet that he's never met before. And so he should have known better, which is why he gets in trouble. And a lot of people get upset when they hear this story because it's like, wow, this guy was doing God's will, and then he got in trouble because he believed somebody that lied to him? Yeah. The same way that back when I was in the military, if I had been given very direct orders by my commander to do something, and then somebody else came and said, hey, the commander told me that you didn't have to do that, I would be required to go and check in with the commander to verify that. I could not trust that other person. I would need to authenticate the message. And so this guy broke his own rules, broke his own directives. He didn't check in with higher headquarters to see if that really was a change. Verse 20. So they sat down at the table, and then the word of he who is came to the prophet who had brought him back. This is another twist on the story. God possesses this lying prophet and uses him to pass on a message to the prophet that had not followed orders. He cried to the man of God who came from Judah, thus says he who is, because you've disobeyed the word of he who is and have not kept the command that he who is your God commanded you, but have come back and have eaten bread and drunk water in the place in which he said to you, don't eat bread and drink water, your body shall not come to the tomb of your fathers. Wow. So he gets a death penalty for this. This is serious stuff, folks. I know a lot of people that really feel bad for this guy, and in some respects I do, but he should have known better. God had given him a very serious command, a very serious mission, and he should have kept that mission to the letter, unless God himself changed it in the exact same way he gave it. And that didn't happen. And so it doesn't matter that he got lied to. He should have checked in with God. All of us are responsible for keeping the word of God, regardless of what somebody else tells us. And so he is told that he is going to die, and furthermore, his body is not going to make it back to his family plot. So verse 23, after he had eaten bread and drunk, which they were probably already done, I doubt that he would have been able to eat and drink much more after getting that prophecy. He saddled the donkey for the prophet whom he had brought back. And as he went away, a lion met him on the road and killed him. His body was thrown in the road. The donkey stood beside it. The lion also stood beside the body. And behold, men passed by. They saw the body thrown in the road, and the lion that was standing by the body. And they came and they told it in the city where the old prophet lived, which we know that he lives at Shiloh, or maybe a village that's associated with the city of Shiloh. And so this is all very quickly. It all happens the same day. And so the prophet, the old prophet, gets wind that the prophecy he'd passed on had come to pass in a very strange way. When a cougar or a mountain lion, which they had lions at this time in Israel, attacks a rider on a donkey, the donkey's going to try to run away. The person may not be the only thing that gets killed if the lion is really ferocious and sees these as food sources or threats. And so this sign of a dead body with a lion that's not eating it, just standing there in the accompaniment of the steed, you know, the donkey that's not running away from the lion and not being harmed by the lion, just standing there as well, that is an amazing thing. And so the prophet decides he's got to go and see this first thing. Plus, he wants to recover the body. When the prophet who had brought him back from the way heard it, he said, "Oh, it's the man of God who disobeyed the word of he who is. Therefore, he who is has given him to the lion, which has torn him and killed him, according to the word that he who is spoke to him." So he said to his sons, "Saddle the donkey for me." They saddled it. He went and he found his body thrown in the road and the donkey and the lion standing beside the donkey. Again, very strange scene here. It gets even stranger now because the lion doesn't attack this old prophet. The donkey still doesn't run away. The lion doesn't run away. It's just a static scene. It says he found the body thrown in the road, the donkey, the lion standing beside the body. The lion had not eaten the body or torn the donkey. And so probably after a bit of hesitation, a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of concern, the prophet gets down from his own donkey and he took up the body of the man of God and he laid it on the donkey. That would be on the man of God's donkey. Because there's two donkeys in the story right now. So he puts that dead body up on the donkey of the man and brought it back to the city to mourn and bury him. So he came back to cry over him and to provide him a grave, an interment, a funeral, which funerals pretty much happened on the day of the death back at that time. And then he laid the body in his own grave. And they mourned over him, saying, "Alas, my brother." So probably he feels some guilt over having been involved in this man's death by lying to him. Probably all because he wanted to piggyback in on this guy's prophetic office. And so it's now all backfired. So the only thing that's left to him is to honor him with a proper burial in his own grave. And then he makes this request of his sons. After he had buried him, he said to his sons, "When I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones." So bury me with this man as part of my honoring of him for being involved in this whole story. Verse 32, "For the saying that he called out by the word of he who is against the altar in Bethel and against all the houses of the high places that are in the cities of Samaria shall surely come to pass." So the old prophet says, I am positive because I'm involved personally in this whole situation. I am positive that everything this man said, the Josiah guy from the city of Jerusalem and from the dynasty of David, the destruction of the altar, the burning of the bones of the priests that were there that day when they were dedicating it, I think all of that's going to come to pass. And that includes also judgment on the false worship that's going on here in northern Israel. Now, this is the first time we see the name Samaria used. It's a little bit jumping the gun, though. Samaria does not exist at this point as a city or as the name for the region. This tells me that whoever is writing this section of 1 Kings, whichever prophet author is writing this, is writing after that became the usual term for the entire region of northern Israel. And we'll get more to that story later. But for now, we have run out of time, and we'll mark our place and get back into the Word next time God gives us opportunity.